Holler, Shalomar Holler is actually a senior investigator and a colleague of mine from the Division of Cancer Epidemiology and Genetics, and he's going to talk about assessing the public health impact of personalized medicine.
Thank you, Nilanjan, for inviting me. My talk is going to touch on some of the very same themes that Rich Simon's talk did, with a little bit broader view, but also mostly focused on cancer, where I work as well. They told me I needed to put in this. I don't have any. Here's my disclosure: no relationships to disclose. Okay. I also thought a little bit about the learning objectives. I'm trying to give an overview, public health perspective, about intervention programs that use personalized medicine, like the kinds that Rich talked about. And it really does have effects on research, on implementation, and evaluation. Now, Rich talked about treatment, but of course, prevention and many people's public health orientation thinks about prevention first. But I think all of this fits together. And a few of the examples I'm going to talk about or not talk about today, that the kinds of thinking that I'm talking about and that Rich did in a special case is quite general. So there's vaccination, HPV for boys, screening, PSA, mammography, and even environmental and occupational regulations have the same kind of idea. So here are just a few stories from actually very recently. This is from Sunday's New York Times. This is the online version, just talking about the general issue of screening. And how you make those kinds of decisions. Screening, you look at that mammogram and you decide what you're going to do with that patient. That's personalized medicine. Here, this is about prostate cancer. This is from last week's New England Journal. And they use the word stratifying risk, which is a theme I'm going to come back to, though they don't use it quite the way that I did. This is the Advisory Council for Immunologic for immunization practices from the CDC. Again, the last week or two, well, it says October 25th, so that was last week, they recommended that 11 and 12-year-old boys get vaccinated against HPV. This one is not so new, but this is also an example, and it fits in with some of the things that Rich said. This is germline mutation, not somatic mutation, but this is Plavix or clopidogrel, which has a black box warning that says that people who carry a particular mutation on a cytokine P450 gene will find that this very popular drug to prevent heart disease, it's a platelet inhibitor, doesn't work for them, or at least not very well. So the general question is, how can risk estimation increase the performance of intervention programs? And talking about prevention of future disease and treatment of existing disease, because it really is a continuum, as Jeffrey Rose pointed out. The principles are really the same, even though I think we tend to put them into different silos. But the public health perspective is about decisions made at the population level. If you want to think about it as policy, then think about it as policy. And what I'm going to be focusing on is the performance of the intervention program, exactly a theme that Rich brought up already. We're not only talking about individual choice, but talking about cost effectiveness as well. And also thinking about opportunity costs. If we vaccinate boys, what does that mean to the vaccination uptake for girls? That's in the HPV story. So the personalized medicine program, and I always think about the program here, is you want to base intervention decisions on individual information and summarize it in a risk model incorporating, obviously, the basic demographics, age, sex, and race, but behavioral variables, endogenous factors. Cholesterol has been a huge success for the statins that probably some of you in this room take. PSA, the controversial prostate cancer. Disease markers, pap smear results, the somatic changes that Rich talked about. So all of these prevention programs have three elements that I think are crucial, and then we follow them with evaluation. Number one is the estimation of the risk before the intervention, the estimation of individual risk after all possible interventions. And then when you have those two pieces, you can assign the most appropriate intervention based on the risk reduction. That's the idea. So I'm going to go over these in a little bit more detail. The estimation of the individual risk, we're talking about natural history. In other words, no change from the outside. No one's telling you what to do. Nobody's making you do anything. What would happen if I didn't take that statin? What would be my risk? Then risk estimations, risk estimates based on the available information. And it's not passive. You can also decide to collect additional information. You want to ask about family history? You want to order a lab test? You want to look for germline DNA? Whether it's a clinical test, it doesn't really matter. All of this is the same. Nothing special about genetics, nothing special about the laboratory. And then you need to use the kind of effective information that you get from a randomized trial, and but for all of the possible interventions, given the individual information. There's where you're going to use the kinds of, gosh, I don't remember which ones are predictive or prognostic biomarkers that Rich talked about, but if you're talking about treatments, then you know which one he meant. And you might go and order a special lab test like OncoDX to help you make those kinds of decisions. But that's all part of the program. And then you think about the net benefit, and that's in terms of the reduction in risk, in terms of the against the total costs and how you can maximize that. And of course, you're thinking about non-financial costs as well, like adverse events. Evaluation. What kind of evaluation do you do? You can compare against current practice. Are we going to do better than we are right now, where maybe every private doc decides for himself or herself what every individual patient will get, based on some simpler assignment scheme, like everybody gets the same. And then you have to ask, at the end, for the whole program, is the improvement worthwhile and cost-effective? Maybe I mean those two words pretty much to mean the same thing. So the performance criteria are going to include primarily an overall reduction in morbidity or mortality for target disease, remembering that some individuals are not going to benefit. When I said primarily, if you don't do this, you're finished. But it's not the only or even the most important thing. You have to be thinking about other dimensions, the impact on other diseases as well as cost. So when you do this, there are different ways of doing it. You can do simulation like we heard Dr. Gillings a little while ago, or the kind of work that Sue Goldie and Jane Kim do up at Harvard. There's observational studies like one I'm going to describe. And I don't know why I thought you were going to talk about exclusively about randomized trials, Rich, but I think of Rich being an advocate of clinical trials, which certainly, as far as I know, haven't been done as extensively in this area. So I want to talk about some of the issues about evaluation. I think they're very important. First of all, you have to choose the best personalized program to evaluate. How do you even decide what we're going to look at? You have to think about duration of follow-up. Even if you only give the treatment for a few months, how far out do you need to see what's going to happen? When do the effects of screening for a prostate cancer appear? Maybe the trials didn't last long enough. Same, you can ask those questions. I don't mean to say that they didn't. And then there are individual issues, when there are ethics of withholding benefit if you're trying to do a trial, for example. And then there's the societal questions as well for things like vaccination, where if you're trying to do a long-term evaluation and nothing happens at the time, there are real costs. And you need to consider those, not just your type 1 or type 2 error. So, and then there's the scope of the impact of intervention. Some of them mitigate the benefit, like adverse events from drugs or surgery or vaccination, or take something like tamoxifen, which is a both for therapy as well for prevention for breast cancer, but it does increase the risk of endometrial cancer and stroke, and those are things you need to think about. But also, some of these interventions have multiple positive effects. So obviously, smoking prevention not only helps us at the Cancer Institute, but at the even more so at the Heart and Lung Institute. HPV vaccination not only prevents cervical cancer and vulvar cancer, as in the original planned in the original trials, but there's a pretty good indication, though it's certainly not proven and it's not on the label yet, that other HPV-related cancers that are actually quite common might be protected as well. And the HPV infections that the vaccine works against aren't just the two it's designed for. There's actually some cross-protection. And then there's the genital warts, which actually were part of the Gardasil program. Here's another really difficult evaluation issue, and that's estimating those risk differences. Remember, think of what that program is. When you make the assignment, you're seeing who's going to benefit, and we're always talking about those risk differences. Usually, we have to rely on relative risk estimates from the literature, hazard ratios, odds ratios, whatever it is. But it's really hard to know whether the percent reduction is the same regardless of the baseline risk, when in fact there can be a rather large range in what the baseline risk is going to be. And then the other issue is the individual characteristics, the kinds of pharmacogenomics, and that's where we'll talk about where just to return to the clopidogrel example. And then you have to think about the accuracy of the risk models. And this is, I'm thinking back to some work that I did many years ago on the penetrance for breast cancer from BRCA mutations. In other words, what's the risk for a woman, say, before she's age 70 if she carries a BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutation? And in this paper, what we showed was that the standard 85% risk that people were talking about is really closer to 50%. So it's not a sure thing, it's a coin flip. It's obviously very serious, but you can have, if your risk model tells you that it's 85 and it's really 50, you might make a different decision about the kind of prophylactic surgeries that are being offered. And then there's cost and externalities. Costs, the financial, more sensitive tests, I'll talk about one, can reduce the frequency of testing. Instead of a pap smear, if you use HPV testing and you're negative, you can wait for a few years before you go back to the gynecologist. You have to think about the cost of risk estimation, like the lab tests, and you have to talk about opportunity costs as well, the other worthy public health efforts that can spend, that can take that money. And then you have to think about secondary kinds of effects. So when you vaccinate those boys with HPV vaccine, not only will it help them reduce their risk of genital warts, but it almost certainly will affect the rate of cervical cancer in their partners and their partners' partners. So we saw the slide already. So when we talk about performance, or when I talk about performance, I always want to say, what's the totality of the effects across the individuals? It's the program. You need to compare methods to assign the interventions to individuals, but then evaluate over everybody, and then ask which method of assignment, which program that you can develop has the best benefit-to-cost trade-off. Now, there are some real hard things in this that aren't really statistics, and that's values. You need to weigh the positive and negative effects of the program, and that means deciding questions like the relative importance of lives saved and years of life saved. You need to look at the impact of morbidity of different kinds, one kind of cancer versus another, stroke versus a reduction in breast cancer. And you need to think about money. Unfortunately, everything really is made equivalent to money, and even if you find it distasteful, the fact is the de facto alternative is that if you can't put it on a money scale, it's just assumed to have zero value, which is not the right answer. And then you have to think from a public health perspective about the difference between the individual and the societal values. So the societal effect is the sum of the individual effects, but again, you have to be counting those externalities. And there are complications about the values. Do I care about the people near me or all over the world? Do I care about the short term or the long term for myself and for others? There are generational trade-offs, rich versus poor, and certainly in this country, between insured and uninsured people. So I want to talk for just a couple of minutes about the statistical evaluation and how people are using discrimination, which I think of as, can I tell who has disease or can I tell who will get disease? And usually this is measured by the area under the curve. But I think it's important to understand that discrimination is necessary but not sufficient. It doesn't tell you anything about risk. It doesn't tell you anything about risk difference. It's only based on ordering, not doesn't tell you anything about the error in the estimation. Just think of that BRCA penetrance problem. The area under the curve is going to be perfectly fine because no one is at 50%, no one is at 90%, at 85%, except those BRCA carriers, but it makes a huge difference in terms of the value of the program, at least to that small subset of women. So I think the key is risk stratification rather than area under the curve. I think we should go right to it instead of thinking about area under the curve. So this is a paper by my colleague and the Langen's colleague, Hormuz Katki, and others, myself included, where we're thinking about cervical cancer prevention and talking about how risk can combine. A risk estimate combines all of the information. These guys are using, the gynecologists are using these very complicated algorithms to make decisions, but they don't have the kind of consistency that you can get if you characterize everything by a single measure of risk. And that's one of the things that Hormuz is doing. And here's some data that Hormuz gathered and led project. We're looking at prevention of cervical cancer with either HPV testing or pap smears or a combination. These are 330,000 women in Kaiser Permanente in Northern California, followed for 5 years for CIN3+, cervical intraepithelial neoplasia stage 3 or higher, precancer or cancer. And remember the advantage, if you use the HPV test, you can extend the interval before the next test. And this paper appeared this year in Lancet Oncology. And here is a simple presentation of key results. Look at the difference between the HPV positive and the HPV negative, 7.4%. This is the kind of risk stratification you get with a single HPV test. And this is the kind of risk stratification you get with the standard pap smear. And the guidelines that are out there that your gynecologist may not be following or keep pushing for the familiar pap smear and the annual visit, but over 5 years, the precancer risk is enormously low. So when you assess this risk stratification, it's actually kind of complicated. You need to think about the individual, how you're going to, the more variability you have, the more opportunity you have for individualized intervention to improve performance. You want variation in the risk estimates. Zero variation means everybody is assigned to the average risk. So here's another paper published last year about common genetic variants in breast cancer risk models, where we used area under the curve primarily in the paper, and I was the first author. I'm responsible. I'm not sure it was exactly the right thing. We had 6,000 cases and controls. We compared several risk models, and the question was, what happens when you add genes to this personalization effort? And we concluded that adding genes didn't improve the area under the curve very much. The editorial basically said it was a tiny step. I think that was exactly right. But here's another way of presenting what we did with that wasn't in the paper. And you'll notice, first of all, that this is 5-year risk of breast cancer for 55-year-old white American women, 4 risk models, demographics, the standard Gale factors known for many years, using the genes, but not the Gale, and then on the far side, using everything that we had. Everything's calibrated, so the average risk is the same. Look and see what the risk stratification is and see how far you can go from at the first percentile and the 99th percentile compared to the various ones. And you see that adding the genes doesn't do very much on the top, but may show you slightly lower risk down at the lowest risk. And maybe that woman, you might say, maybe she only needs a mammogram every 2 years instead of every one, just for example. So there's a wide range of applicability in this kind of thinking, but there are challenges as well. Finding a good measure of risk stratification, how you develop evidence-based programs based on risk, and allowing continuous improvement. Again, Rich talked about that too. And then the general principles for decision-making at a community level. You need to clarify values. You need to communicate to the public. Part of it is to provide reassurance to those at low risk that they don't need an aggressive intervention, and you need to motivate those at highest risk that they really do need to do something different, like quit smoking, to take one example. And you need to evaluate personalized medicine at the population level. Accept the fact that there are losers or winners. Prevention in individuals becomes reduction in the population. And remember as well that getting to zero can be extremely expensive, and you sometimes need to tolerate a little bit of disease. But you're always looking at total benefit less total cost, summed over everybody eligible for the program. I want to thank some of my colleagues. Thank you very much.
Any questions?
Precisely know the answer. And when you look at that HPV testing versus the PAP testing, and I think you need to go to your gynecologist and say, hey, you know, I'm negative, I'm low risk, do I really need to see you next year? And that's part of the problem, is that your gynecologist's business plan is to see you every year, even if you're not in the baby business right now. You know, that's not where your head is at. And that's a big part of their practice. It's unfair to pick on them, particularly, but it's really hard to describe risks accurately. I think people have risk communicators have been trying very hard to explain what's the risk of evacuating when the hurricane is coming, or the volcano might erupt, or the